cool. Okay. So we're at JPL with yep. One of the robotics experts, the scientists on the Mars rover, the lander. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Glad to do it.
So let's talk a little bit about the complexities of the engineering project. I mean, here you are sending this thing off 100 million miles away. You can never touch it again. Can we talk about how you designed for that problem?
It involves about literally 1,700 different layers of problem solving to build the whole thing. You got to think about the fact that you're basically designing a spacecraft and designing a rover that's going to be operating on the surface of another planet that's 100 and basically based on where the planets are in relationship to each other, anywhere between 100 to 300 million miles apart from each other, which means our ability to talk to it is hampered by a time delay of anywhere from 11 to 30 minutes round trip or single direction light time. Yeah. And so the rover itself has got to be fairly autonomous. It's got to be smart enough to be able to keep itself out of trouble and be smart enough to actually do what you want it to do successfully all throughout the day when you command it. Yeah. It's also going to be able to survive in an environment that has an atmospheric pressure that's extremely low. It's very, very cold. You see temperatures that get down in the neighborhood of 100 degrees below zero on a regular basis, primarily carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere. You've got wind storms and dust storms that are coming through, constantly layering the entire rover with dust and scrubbing it. And so you've got all these different environmental effects you have to contend with, as well as the fact that, oh, by the way, there's no electrical power anywhere. So the entire thing is going to be solar powered and just rely solely on sunlight to be able to operate. And you start to layer all those sort of problems together, and it gets into a fairly significant engineering challenge.
Absolutely. Now, you know, when you send a rover to a distant planet, rocky planet like Mars, you actually pick a location for it because clearly, I mean, you have an assumption of where it looks to be interesting from the analysis that you've done from Earth. Yeah. So you try to get a region of...
Typically what we do is we take a look at the entire planet, and then we have a region within that that are, for engineering constraint reasons, are targeted latitudes that we can fit within. For example, with the Spirit and the Opportunity rovers, we had to look between 15 degrees north and 15 degrees south latitudes. So we had this sort of equatorial band that we knew the landing site would be within. And within that band, we'll consider all the scientific interests that might have possible landing site considerations. We'll look at the engineering interests. We'll look at what's safe and what's not. Mm-hmm. And you start compiling all those together, and you can start to winnow down the number of possible landing sites versus the ones that you actually want to go after. We actually started with a set of over 400 potential landing sites. And then through a successive series of different analyses based on science, based on safety, based on engineering, winnowed it down to a handful and actually made our final selections just a couple of weeks prior to launch of the last two landing sites we actually were going to go for.
Outstanding. So one of the things I find really interesting is you have a lot of problems to solve, which means you have a huge collection of humans, smart humans, very specialists in various domains. How do you guys all work together? So you have the engineering people, then you have the scientists, right? Let's talk about that chemistry.
We actually have, depending on exactly how you count, we had about 6,000 people in total who had some hands-on role with the Mars Exploration Rover project at one point or another. There's a core group in terms of the actual operations once we're down on the surface and actually using the rovers. There's a core group of about 100 combination of scientists and engineers who keep them going on a regular basis. And one of the things that's been very unique about this project and its one predecessor project, the Mars Pathfinder mission back in 97, is we really integrated the scientists and the engineering teams very, very closely together. A lot of the engineering staff sit in on the science team meetings and vice versa.
Excellent.
And so they really understand each other's perspectives and each other's jobs, and that's actually helped make the surface operations as enormously efficient as they have been. It's been a real hallmark of success of the whole thing. Mm. The scientists are able to sit and figure out, okay, yes, I want to make these observations. I want the rover to go here and do this, this, and this, and then go there tomorrow and do that. Oh, but I know enough about the engineering constraints because I work with the engineers to know that if I do this sequence, I'm going to blow my power budget, or I'm going to blow my comm budget, or if I do reroute it this way, all of a sudden I've got surplus. And so they understand the engineering constraints, and the engineers have exactly the same process that they go through. When they design an engineering sequence, they say, oh, but if I do this, I can get science results as well. Let me go talk to the science guys.
Excellent. So another question that I find interesting is, so you designed it from the software perspective to be updatable, and you communicated via radio signal, you know, takes, you're saying, 30 minutes. So you could actually send packages and payloads up there to change things, modify things, fix things. But obviously not the case with the hardware. You'll never touch it again.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about redundancy in the hardware version. Do you have multiple versions of testing equipment in case one goes down? You have an up.
What we've done in terms of the hardware redundancy, it happens at several different levels. On the rover itself, for certain selected pieces of the hardware, there are redundant systems that allow us to swap and switch over. If one side fails, we can switch to the other side and keep on going. Mm. for cost constraint reasons, we don't make the entire rover in every single system redundant, but the ones that we think are probably the highest risk or have the potential for failure in it or are most critical, we'll build in redundancy in the hardware at that level. Mm-hmm. And that actually goes all the way through the entire architecture of the rover. You can think of it in one way. You look at the fact we have six wheels. Well, it was designed that way for a reason. If a wheel fails, we can still drive with five wheels. In fact, that is exactly what's happened on Spirit. Where we've actually had one of the wheel drive actuators has locked up. And right now, Spirit is driving with five wheels and just sort of dragging the sixth one. It has been for 2 years now.
Excellent.
And so even at the gross architectural level, we have a certain layer level of redundancy built into the system. But beyond that, in terms of the entire project, we also have the same thing. Number one, we've got two rovers on the surface of Mars. We did that for a reason.
Hmm.
We were landing on another planet, really difficult process. We didn't know that the landing was going to be successful, so we sent a second one in case one of them didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But even beyond that, we have here on Earth several testbed machines built up that allow us to simulate what's going on Mars so that if something starts to fail, we don't have to rely on just telemetry from the surface of Mars to understand the problem. Instead, we can simulate it here, figure it out, diagnose it, troubleshoot it, and hopefully send a solution up that can bypass a broken piece of hardware if we have to.
That's really, really awesome. So you're working on a new rover.
We are.
And let's talk about it. What's new? What's different in this machine?
The mission we're working on right now, which is going to launch about a year from now, is the Mars Science Lab mission, or MSL. It'll be launching in late 2009. And basically, MSL, one way to think of it is the big brother of the Spirit and the Opportunity rovers. It's a much physically larger machine. Spirit and Opportunity were small machines, about the size of a golf cart, whereas MSL will be larger, about the size like a VW Beetle. It'll be designed to go farther, last longer, and do a more intense analysis of the environment on the surface of Mars. Whereas the MER rover, Spirit and Opportunity, they were designed to go 600 meters over the course of their lifetime. Now, they actually have done much more than that, but their design constraint was 600 meters.
Mm-hmm.
MSL is being designed for several kilometers of distance. Spirit and Opportunity were designed to last for 90 days. Obviously, they lasted much longer than that.
Yes.
But MSL is being designed to last for 2 years.
Nice.
And so it's a much more robust, much more capable system. This is the Institute Instrument Lab, or ISIL, which is one of the facilities where what we actually do is test a lot of the command sequences that are sent up to the rovers on the surface of Mars before they're actually transmitted to make sure that they are executing properly on the rover. The rover body that you see down here on the right in the corner is a full-size engineering model of the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. And internally and electronically, it's all identical to the ones that's actually sitting on the surface. And so what we're able to do if we need to is we can actually engineer the surfaces down here into any sort of shape that we want to, put in slopes, make false craters, things like that, then have the rover drive through the environment to make sure that it's going to behave the way that we expect it to. And we've used this many, many times during the surface missions. Right after landing, for example, Opportunity landed in what later became known as Eagle Crater, a small, about 10-meter diameter crater. So we actually built Eagle Crater in this room, put the rover inside it, and as we would drive around inside the crater, we'd actually test that command sequence here before we ever actually uplinked it to the rover to do for real. And we use this facility all the time to do that. And one of the things that you'll see is that actually they're turning the lights up right now, so the room is getting a little bit brighter. With the surface or the ceiling lights that are in here, we're actually able to replicate Mars ambient lighting. And the thing that typically surprises a lot of people when the lights are up fully is when you realize how bright it is on the surface of Mars. Even though on average it's about 1.5 to 2 times as far away from the sun as the Earth is, because the atmosphere is so thin, mm-hmm. much less of the sunlight is filtered out by the atmosphere. So actually at the equatorial regions where the two rovers are operating, it's actually like standing on top of about a 12,000-foot mountain at the equator on Earth. It's very, very bright.
And the folks who work here have to wear sunscreen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that tends to be a real surprise. But it also explains why we're able to have these rovers operated off solar power with no real problem at all, because they do have that much sunlight, especially in the mid-latitudes.
Interesting.
The rover that you do see down here, as I mentioned, that's full scale, so that's actually the size of the rover itself, that's the two rovers that are sitting on the surface of Mars. There's a full-up replica. The one that's on the left doesn't have the solar arrays or the instrument mast fully set up. It's basically being used primarily just as a mobility test bed. The one that's over here on the right does have the full equipment complement on board, so you can really get a sense of exactly how big the rover is when it's sitting on the surface of Mars and driving around. And actually, one of the other things that has become sort of a naturally evolved part of the entire activity is you can see the layer of dust that's sitting on the surface of the panels right there. That's actually right now a pretty good analog for what we're seeing in terms of the dust layer that's been deposited on the rovers on Mars as well. The thing has been a real pleasant surprise for us and that has contributed to how long they've lasted is that every now and then, periodically, you get these little tiny dust devils on the surface of Mars that come across. They happen to hit the rover, and they actually will clean the arrays off and scrub them off and clean them.
Wow.
If you look at a plot of power over time, you basically see over several months the power level slowly, slowly dropping off, and all of a sudden, boom, there's this big spike, and it goes back up. And that's a cleaning event, and it happens again. It's happened 5 times to us so far. It's really pretty neat. Actually, it was a point about 4 months ago where we actually had the arrays so clean and the environmental effects were just perfect. We actually had more power 4.5 years into the mission than we had the day that we landed.
Wow.
So that was pretty
cool. Camouflage material, its back wall is for its cameras, so it has a mock landscape, so it's not looking at a white wall.
Yeah,
the
camera systems on board the rover, there's actually several different cameras that are available both on the mast and mounted to the body of the rover, and we use stereoscopic vision for doing visual odometry to watch how far the rover is driving when it's being commanded to do an autonomous drive. In this room, things that are very large blank expanses where the stereo can't converge cause problems. That's why the camouflage went up, just to give texture to the background so the convergence algorithm would work.
And the material on the floor is crushed volcanic rock. And when one of the rovers, Opportunity, got stuck in a sand trap, they had to figure out what material to use. And so they mixed diatomaceous earth, which if you have a swimming pool, you might know about, and a bunch of other materials to kind of simulate the real sandy, fine-grained material that it was trapped in, and we were able to get it out from there. We used to have a ramp in here, too, where they were testing slope tolerance. It was designed for 45, is that right?
And then, yeah. We limit it to 30.
30,
right.
Exactly. And it asked for help if it's beyond that. We found out that we actually were able to go down some slopes we didn't think so or didn't design for, so that was really exciting.
The one other thing I want to point out in particular as well is right over here against the far wall, just to the left of the wooden crate, you can see it's sort of the folded-up pyramid shape.
Yes.
And that actually is, again, a full-scale mock-up of the lander itself. The whole rover would fold up and fit inside of that, and then once we landed, the pedals, which would be the top three pedals on the sides, would basically open up, and then the rover would unfold itself just like a big piece of origami and stand up and be able to drive off.
And that was necessary because we were trying to fit it into the same size and shape of Sojourner, which was a footstool, the first rover on Mars. So, ingenious.
And what would happen is on the outside of that would be where the airbags attached. And this is the picture I was looking for. When the airbag, you can see the size of the lander. When the airbag stacks is fully inflated, that's in this room, the whole stack would basically come up to the ceiling of this room. So that thing that you see in the animation of this nice little airbag bouncing around, realize that nice little thing is this big.
Wow.
It's huge. And it's bouncing around on the surface of Mars, having been dropped for many, many meters. Mm-hmm. And it's got a good bit of life to it for a while before it actually settles out.
You can see this one was tested from the scuff marks on the ground and test several layers. And it's okay if the outer layers break. That's intentional.
So what was the velocity?
You can see how they tore right here.
I can double check the numbers to see, and I'll tell you the range, but I don't remember the exact numbers. But basically what we did is we designed it so that the thing we're in particular concerned about, the reason for all the testing, and Michelle mentioned the rips that you'll see here, is we did a lot of testing in particular to look at horizontal velocities as we impact, and we're worried about rocks that would tear the airbags open. And so we're designed to be able to handle up to like 40 meters a second, sort of very significant velocities. What we actually saw was much, much lower than that. If I recall correctly, it was on the order of like 4 meters a second. So it was a relatively straight down drop. Wasn't too bad, but we were prepared for much worse. The nightmare scenario was you had this nice little triangular pyramid rock sticking up that had a nice knife blade edge on it that you ran into at high speed and sort of tear the airbag open. It was all over. And so we're designing against that possibility. What you've basically got effectively are 7 different layers of Kevlar fabrics crosswoven and everything else that are lining these things before you get to the pressure bladders inside.
How many years in development was the project?
It all depends on how you count it. The actual project itself, from literally the green light to go and make this happen to launch, was 37 months, 3 years and a month, which for spacecraft development is extraordinarily fast. The reality was that the technology development, a lot of the pre-engineering on the subsystems before we actually had a mission in the research programs goes back easily 25 years. So the reason we were able to do it in 37 months was because we had a lot of the pieces that had been pre-built without knowing that they were going specifically into this mission. Right.
It's very analogous to the way we did robotic developer studios. We leveraged off a lot of existing
right.
Microsoft technology, and we were able to work a lot quicker as a result. So,
right.
So I have a question. How much analysis is done on the system? So in other words, it the machinery runs, detects things. Because you mentioned you get a lot of data. How much analysis happens on board, and then you get the results of the analysis sent back?
In terms of the science data, mm-hmm. almost none, and it's specifically because the scientists don't trust the software yet. They basically say, I want to see all the real data. I mean, here the ultimate nightmare scenario we have with them is we keep trying to tell them, look, we can have the onboard software do the first-order analysis for you and start to give you results. And mm-hmm. their immediate rejoinder is, look, when you get to the point where the software is able to analyze the data, give me the results, extract the information, and write my paper for me, then I'm interested. Until then, I want to see the raw data.
Pure science.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but other than that, most of the engineering data, we extract stuff out, and we'll get some abstracted information. But still, there as well, we have the ability, if we need to get down to the original raw data as well and tap into it if we need it for the engineering purposes.
Cool.
I was telling a lot of folks yesterday about the algorithms that they sent out to help it navigate on its own.
Yep.
Talk about that?
Yeah, one of the things we did, and this goes back to sort of the question of how much was built for the mission, how much was pre-built technology. We had a robotics technology program that goes back into the early 70s. It had been doing surface robotics research and development for years. And one of the things we wanted to do in terms of this mission, especially as it started to go on and on, we had a lot of longevity to it, is take advantage of the fact we've got great stereo capabilities on board the rover. We've got, in some cases, these nice flat open planes with relatively few hazards. The opportunities for autonomous driving are wonderful, and so we've started to increase, and we've actually been able to upload the software, or upgrade the software on board the rovers since it's landed 9 times, and put new capabilities on board each time. And we have autonomous driving capabilities now where we basically, in effect, to drive the rovers. We're now at the point where we designate a target and tell the rover, go there, you figure out how to do it, and let us know either you get there successfully or you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. Until then, we don't hear from you. And the rover is able to autonomously do that all by itself. And you look at one of the most interesting photos we have is from early on with Spirit, about 2 months after landing. And it happens to have had the camera turn around looking back at the wheel tracks on the surface of Mars that it left behind as it was driving. And there's this one really interesting feature where you see basically driving a straight path, and all of a sudden about halfway down the path, there's this big left jog, and then it resumes its path and continues on. And it was where the rover autonomously recognized a rock, determined it was big enough to be an obstacle, drove around it, and then got back on the original path and continued, all based on onboard software. Terrestrially, yeah. I mean, but it's the sort of thing where in the robotics research community, I mean, we were all doing this stuff 10 years ago, and it's not that big a deal. But you realize this is the first time it ever happened on another planet completely autonomously. That's cool.
Now, as you look a little bit, you know, not in the too distant future, but in the future, you never know exactly what you're going to find out. Maybe you have an orbiting, you know, device. There could be something really interesting that just happened, like maybe some geologic activity that you didn't expect. Are you thinking about perhaps building a device or a rover that could actually go on wheels and also fly?
We've looked at actually several different ideas for Mars aircraft, either actually literally airplanes or balloons or various different things like that. We haven't looked at the idea necessarily of a single combined system that would be one monolithic unit that could do both, but rather the idea of I've got a rover that may have a deployable aircraft on it that I could that
send out for missions.
If something happens, something exciting happened, we know, for example, that there are landslides on Mars. We've actually seen evidence of them. We actually have a photograph that we've actually captured of a landslide in process. Mm-hmm. So we know there are events like that happen. Mm-hmm. If the rover was driving around and something happened like that was of interest and we were able to respond in time and you had a deployable aircraft or balloon that could do altitude observations, then it might be a perfect opportunity for you. So those sort of things are design decisions that we're taking a look at constantly as we put these missions together.
Excellent. And we were talking earlier off camera about what programming language you're using. And a lot of our audience, obviously, are professional programmers. And you're mentioning C. So it's C in space. Has that always been the case? Is it always C?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, C actually, and the use of C has been fairly recent. But, you know, if you go back into the early days of the missions in spaceflight, we used to do everything literally was hand-coded in assembler.
Okay.
And it's just been a progression up as you get environments and operating systems that are more and more capable and that are better suited to the real-time environment that we have to operate in, that we can use. We're able to make use of standard off-the-shelf components for a lot of the basic work and the underpinnings for a lot of these systems now. You know, we use a commercial real-time operating system as the basic environment for the rovers, and we'll use the same thing for MSL. Mm-hmm. And so as much as we possibly can, we like to make use of that capability, because then we can focus on stuff that's truly unique to the design problem we have.
Outstanding. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to do it.
Unbelievable work. And
it's
been fun. Luck with the next one.
Thanks.
Thank you. You got your money that you owe me?
Right.
What's going on here?